Okay, hello everyone. Good morning. I'm going to be taking you through to the end of this term and through to the end of your readings in modes of reading. Today's lecture, as you know, is on Hanif Qureshi's The Buddha of Suburbia. And the lecture is going to be in roughly four parts. I hope to cover these four topics. In the first part, I will talk about how I read the novel as representing historical transition and change. In the second part, I want to talk about race, class, and gender issues in the novel. Then move on to talking about maps of Englishness, how the novel maps what Englishness is all about, spatially, geographically, etc. And finally, talk about the structure of the novel, the way in which the narrative resolves itself. But before I go into any of that, I want to show you a brief clip, which I hope you will enjoy. And now I just hope this works. Okay, yeah. I think this is the one that has the song. And you can listen to the song. Okay, that was just a brief audio clip of the famous God Save the Queen, the fascist regime, There Is No Future. This is the song by Sex Pistols that emblematized the 1970s as a decade that saw the rise and power of punk music. And this is the decade in which the Buddha of Suburbia is set. It is also an idea that is quite central to the portrait of 1970s London that Qureshi draws in the novel. Okay. This is the decade of economic crisis that sparked national anxieties and anxieties about the self, society, nation. The decade represented a crisis of the welfare state as large-scale unemployment hit society. It was also a decade in which the radical energies of the 1960s counterculture began to seem effete and powerless. The students' movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, the civil rights and new left movements that had all started in the 1960s, people began to question where those movements were going and what would be the efficacy of those movements in terms of changing society, class structures, etc. The 1970s was also the decade that spawned rebellious subcultures and youth cultures, evidenced in fashion. If you remember, well, you wouldn't remember, but if you've seen images of the 1970s, the images of people wearing bell-bottoms and Levi's jeans, the decade of new kinds of music, advertising, drugs, experimental sex and sexuality, experimental mysticism, right? That in the 1980s becomes mainstreamed and co-opted. The 1970s is also the decade in which progressive rock and hippie culture gave way to a grittier punk music, the recording that you just heard, the decade in which musicians like Bob Dylan, Syd Barrett, Kevin Ayers, Soft Machine, Rolling Stones, the novel, as you know, is awash with names and references and allusions to the music of the 1960s and 70s, these kinds of musicians, the Third Ear Band, Hawkwind, Beatles, Pink Floyd, are seen as too soft, okay, as seen as too effete. The youth culture that the novel presents militates against this form of music and this form of hippie culture that gives way to the rise of the punk movement. On page 131 of the novel, and I'm not sure which editions you have, but I will tell you, this is chapter 9. So you just make a note of it. You don't need to refer to it right away, where Charlie says that the 60s have been given notice tonight. This is the gig that he's performing in. Those kids we saw have assassinated all hope. They are the fucking future. This idea of the assassination of hope, right, is quite central to the whole atmosphere that the Buddha of Suburbia evokes. On page 153, there is talk of the new nihilism, the new hopelessness, railing against the Beatles song, the well-known Beatles song, All You Need Is Love, right? The characters are cynical about that notion that, you know, that the 60s hippie notion that all you need is love to solve societal problems. The novel also registers a great deal of cynicism towards political activism, right? Towards hope, towards progressive values. There's a great deal of cynicism on the part of many characters. So what I'm trying to sketch is the backdrop of the Buddha of Suburbia, right? The 1970s that mark a certain kind of turning point that displays the evisceration of the hopes and energies and the radicalism of the 1960s and leads to a certain kind of cynicism, nihilism, despair, hopelessness, but also anger towards the state of society, towards the economic situation, etc., in the 1970s. Now, what I want to argue is that the novel, in fact, while it is set against the backdrop of this mood, this national mood in Britain, and I think that, you know, throughout the talk, at least in my head, I'm sort of seeing parallels with perhaps today's moment, right, in which, you know, there is again a kind of questioning of, you know, the economy, of the education system, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm sure you will also note some interesting parallels or echoes for our own time. Now, what I want to argue is that the novel juxtaposes this cynicism, right? This rebellion, which is in many ways an empty kind of rebellion of the main characters in The Buddha of Suburbia, against an enduring innocence and faith in progressive change and transformation. Okay, so that's the first point I really want to make in today's lecture, is that there is this backdrop of hopelessness, nihilism, cynicism, and despair that sets in the 1970s with growing unemployment and, you know, the youth sort of stuck in older structures, and the hopes of many of the progressive movements seem to be sort of on the decline, that the novel juxtaposes that sense of despair and nihilism against an enduring faith in transformation, in change, in progress, in innocence itself. And there's this kind of interesting tension between the two throughout this novel. Of course, one very obvious example in the novel a kind of instance of hope and of looking forward is in the figure of Jamila, right, who represents in the novel the women's movement as well as anti-racist movements that were gaining in popularity, even as many of the ideals of those movements were being questioned. In the novel, Jamila is one such figure, right? She reads Simone de Beauvoir, she listens to the blues. She's inspired by the African-American civil rights movement, in particular by the African-American feminist and civil rights activist Angela Davis. Okay? So there are several characters apart from Jamila, but Jamila is one of the most important ones, who do embody this idea that in spite of all the hopelessness, there is the possibility of change. There is the possibility of questioning the system. Now, what is key to this theme of historical change and transition that I've just talked about, right, this idea that something was shifting in the 1970s, is the idea of self-fashioning, okay, which I think is a really key theme throughout the novel. The idea that one could make oneself, right, anew, make oneself different, of which changing fashion became only a superficial manifestation. And as you know, that there are so many references throughout the novel to changing fashion. So the question was, how was to fashion oneself in step with the times, right? What was this idea? How was one to make oneself anew, given the tensions and the struggles of the 1970s as a decade, okay? And here the idea of education and of the education system is quite key in the novel. Okay, and I just want to focus on a couple of quotes. The first one is from chapter 7. The education system and I had split up. It would break his immigrant heart too. But the spirit of the age among the people I knew manifested itself as general drift and idleness. We didn't want money. What for? We could get by living off parents, friends, or the state. Okay? This is a very quite an important and interesting quote because this emphasizes this whole idea of self-education, right? The novel's questioning of established institutions of education versus the idea that people could educate themselves. And that idea of self-education was predicated on checking out of the system, right? That education did not do much for the working classes, for instance. In fact, the education system was based on solidifying class divisions, right? And the novel seems to implicitly argue that the welfare state ironically fed into this, right? This idea that one could live off the state that created a multi-tier educational system in which the working classes were pushed towards careers, towards jobs, towards vocational education. And as I said at the beginning, I think these are still such live issues for us today, right, as the whole education system is up for overhaul, or some people might even say dismantling. Now, this, of course, comes up in the novel, this cynicism towards the education system that is seen as merely feeding into the already existing class divides that the characters in the novel face. This, of course, comes up against immigrant aspiration, for which education is the vehicle for class mobility. And this is one of the tensions that shapes Karim, right? So he has a father who wants him to be successful, to go through the education system, and yet Karim is split between his father's aspirations, his father's ambitions, and his own attachment to the youth culture, to the spirit of drift and idleness, right? Which is, I think, quite an interesting phrase here, drift and idleness, which in a way becomes an instrument for questioning a kind of economistic, instrumentalist education system, right? Which says that the purpose of education is to find a job and earn money, right? And here you see Karim and his cohort actually rejecting that whole notion of education. The novel then is about 17-year-old Karim and his coming of age in this decade of crisis, okay? Caught between the immigrant desires for upward mobility, his father says, oh yes, he'll be a leading doctor in London, and the desire to break free, and in desiring to do so, to belong, to partake in what it was to be young then, okay? And this seems to be very specific to Karim's predicament, being caught between these two pressures. Now, immigrants, it's interesting to note that they were the ones who could ironically slide between class positions to a greater extent in a society still very mired in older class distinctions. And I think that's one perhaps interesting thing to talk about in your seminars, whether Karim's racial and immigrant status gives him greater mobility to move between different subcultures, right? And if you compare him with the other English characters who seem to be very much mired in older class distinctions. And the novel, of course, does a very fine job of detailing the class system in Britain of the 1970s. So you have Karim's mother, who's working class. So she's English, but she's working class. And you have Karim's father, who is an immigrant, but he's an upper middle class person from India. So there's a kind of interesting collision of class issues and class cultures there. Then, of course, there's Eva, who's middle class bohemian, and Eleanor, who is upper class, right? So the novel does present a quite vast canvas of people belonging to different classes, right, and clashing with each other and coming across each other and negotiating their specific class culture. But this seeming malleability and maneuverability of class positions, right, especially on the part of immigrants, comes up against the limits of the English nation and provides the novel with its central tension. Okay, and this is the second quote on this page that I want to focus on, where Karim says, "Yea, sometimes we were French, Jamie and I," because of course they loved to read French philosophy, right? "And other times we went Black American. The thing was, we were supposed to be English, but to the English, we were always wogs and nigs and parkies and the rest of it." I think if one has to pick out any quote from the novel, this would be one of the really key ones, right? Where Karim is, you know, quite directly talking about the fact that while identity can be seen as a certain kind of performance, right, particularly within youth culture, right, the fact that these young people can insert themselves into various progressive, subversive cultures, national, but also international. I think what I find interesting about this youth culture is the internationalism of it, right? The influence of, you know, American music and Eastern mysticism, etc., right? So while for these young people, right, these identities can be performed or they can be worn for a while as you would different fashions, right? The key point here is that to the English, we were always wogs and nigs and parkies and the rest of it, right? And this is the tension. This is really the key point in many ways that the novel makes about the limits of performing identity. In fact, about the limits of Englishness itself, what it is able to accommodate and what it cannot, what it has to leave out. Okay. With this, I want to move to the next part of the lecture, which I want to, I've sort of titled, "We Are with Enoch." That's what Harry Back says to Karim in the novel on page 40. Now, apart from the fact that there was all this sense of hopelessness that had to do with growing economic problems by the 70s, growing unemployment, et cetera, it was also a decade of tremendous racial trouble and racial divide in Britain, okay? It's a decade of racial trouble. And this phrase, "We are with Enoch," I think we need to flesh it out, and I want to do a bit of that. For those of you who've not heard of Enoch Powell, this "We are with Enoch" statement is a reference to Enoch Powell, who was a Tory politician who gave this famous "Rivers of Blood" speech on the eve of the Race Relations Bill, which was passed in 1968, okay? And this is a quite key historical moment for the Buddha of suburbia, because in a way it changed the way in which race was going to be discussed in Britain from then on. Okay, and I will just read out a couple of extracts from that speech. The first one: here is the means of showing that the immigrant communities can organize to consolidate their members, to agitate and campaign against their fellow citizens, and to overawe and dominate the rest with the legal weapons which the ignorant and the ill-informed have provided. Here, of course, he's referring to the British state providing more rights to immigrants and to people of other races. But of course, Enoch Powell is filled with fear, right, at this idea that immigrants are going to have more rights in Britain. As I look ahead, I'm filled with foreboding. Like the Roman, I seem to see the River Tiber foaming with much blood. Okay, and here you can sort of see the deliberately aggressive language here, the reference to the River Tiber foaming with much blood. That tragic and intractable phenomenon which we watch with horror on the other side of the Atlantic, but which there is interwoven with the history and experience of the states itself, is coming upon us here by our own volition and our own neglect, right? So this tide of immigrants is coming and going to consume Britain. Indeed, it has all but come. In numerical terms, it will be of American proportions long before the end of the century. Only resolute and urgent action will avert it even now. Whether there will be the public will to demand and obtain that action, I do not know. All I know is that to see and not to speak would be the great betrayal. Okay? Now, this speech, as you can imagine, is not just a landmark speech, but has been written about and talked about quite extensively. And I just hope to show you a brief clip of it, or about it, rather. Sorry. What is happening?
In this country, in 15 or 20 years' time, the black man will have the whip hand over the white man. I can already hear the chorus of execration. How dare I say such a horrible thing? How dare I stir up trouble and inflame feelings by repeating such a conversation? My answer is that I do not have the right not to do so.
Okay. I'm going to... This is the famous Enoch Powell giving that speech. In the context of this, we can see then how the novel depicts the rise of racism and the presence, the presence of skinheads, of neo-fascist groups, the National Front becoming an important force, the firebombing of black and Asian homes and shops, beatings, racial slurs, and abuse. These race troubles.
What is whom the gods wish to destroy,
did I not? Sorry about this. Did I not stop it? Sorry about this. Okay, hopefully he'll leave us alone. that these race troubles are happening in the context of economic trouble and rising immigration, okay? So there is a very specific historical context then to the whole idea of racial struggle and race tensions, and against which the novel is positing a particular version or a particular ideal, I will go on to say, about the possibility of different races existing within the English nation. And here again, I cannot help but comment on the ways in which this older debate, one would think that this debate about keeping immigrants out or representing immigrants, you know, as this tide that's going to swamp the English nation, that we would have left behind this debate. But if you're following recent news, you would know that this has been resurrected in David Cameron's very recent speech, I think just 3-4 days ago, where he calls for the need for a muscular liberalism, right? That, you know, Britain needs to rededicate itself to ideas of universalism, and I think that's, you know, quite clearly a code word for Englishness, and that must be pursued with an emphasis on muscular liberalism. So here I think, you know, you see how the discourse has changed in a way, right? It's much more perhaps sophisticated because he's talking about liberalism, right? Which one would think is about inclusivity. But I think the use of the word muscular is quite interesting because it is also a kind of a threat, right? That this liberalism is going to be enforced in a muscular way, as well as having, I think, gender connotations, right? This whole notion of muscular liberalism. Okay. With this, I sort of want to move to the topic of the maps of Englishness. Now, one of the main arguments I want to now make is that the novel can be read as engaged in drawing new maps of Englishness. Okay? In many ways, one can read The Buddha of Suburbia as being written in the long tradition of the immigrant novel, right? Whose precursors can be seen as Jean Rhys, her novel Voyage in the Dark, which was about a 19-year-old girl emigrating from the Caribbean and coming to London in the 1910s and 20s, Sam Selwyn's Lonely Londoners, which you read in the first part of this term, Timothy Moore's work, V.S. Naipaul's work, so that one can read the publication of the novel as both a part of this tradition, right, of writing about immigrant culture in the metropolis, right, in the heart of the English nation. But at the same time, I also see the novel as marking a turning point in that tradition, because what is really key to this novel is the fact that the protagonist is British-born. He's not an immigrant himself, right? So in a way, you can see The Buddha of Suburbia as quite a distinctive novel, as being among the first of the immigrant novels that deals with a protagonist who is British, right? Albeit his identity is hyphenated because of his parentage and because of his Asian heritage. So what the novel then does is that through this protagonist, it hopes to, or it tries to blow up the myth of a homogeneous Englishness, right? The idea that Englishness is something homogeneous, right? That idea the novel wants to tear up. And in its place, suggests that a new nation is being forged out of the rubble of colonialism, right? Because of course we cannot forget that it was the whole history of colonialism, right, that sees the presence of immigrants in Britain in the first place, right? So there's a whole colonial history which forms the backdrop of all debates and arguments over multiculturalism in Britain, both in the 1970s and I think today, right? And you can sort of see the shadow of colonial legacy. I don't know if you all have, you know, come across, this is a very famous graffiti that was written up in Southall, which is the South Asian borough of London, which sort of had sprawled across it, "We are here because you were there," right? And this has been, you know, it's been, you know, printed and talked about in many places. So what the novel then is really invested in is this idea of a new nation, right, that can be made, Right? Again, this idea of making out of the rubble of colonialism and against the challenges of politicians like Enoch Powell. Okay. Sorry, I have to do it. Okay. In fact, one of the important quotes in the novel is the immigrant is the everyman of the 20th century. Right. So, in a way, making the immigrant condition not exceptional, right? Not something that is out of the mainstream, but in fact something that is a more generalized condition, the idea of belonging to several cultures, to several places, and to several ideas, to several kinds of subcultures, et cetera, so that you have in the novel the juxtaposition of immigrant hybridity, right, with racist homogeneity, right? So there are these opposing forces that the novel narrates, of immigrant multiculturalism against suburban anomie and sameness, right? So those are the sort of ideas that are colliding against each other in the novel. Homogeneity versus hybridity and heterogeneity, multiculturalism versus sameness, right? And the novel seems to suggest that that is a big challenge for the English nation, right? For Britain, in fact, to open it up to all, okay? And the other quote I want to sort of focus on in this context is, perhaps it is the odd mixture of continents and blood, of here and there, of belonging and not, that makes me restless and easily bored. Or perhaps it was being brought up in the suburbs that did it, okay? So here we see that the novel is not only showing a collision of different values, but those values also have to do with space, right? With the kinds of places that the characters inhabit in the novel and the values associated with those places. So that you have London in the novel as a kind of model for the multicultural nation, right? And you see that in a lot of fiction, which is, you know, typically categorized as immigrant fiction or multicultural fiction. And in more recent times, you have Zadie Smith's The White Teeth, Monica Ali's Brick Lane, et cetera, that are all sort of set in London. So there's a way in which London has sort of achieved this kind of special status, where it's sort of become a symbol for the nation, for the possibilities of the nation as a whole. For Karim, the move to the city is against dullness, right? So he talks about leaving the suburbs as in his attempt to fight against dullness. It's represented as a flight into temptation, right? Against dullness and into temptation. It is in London where he sees slums for the first time, where, quote, the niggers lived, right? The London, so it's the first time that he sees the entirety, in a way. Again, this whole idea of the city encapsulating the nation, the entirety of social classes and of the social and economic divide. But also, as before he says, it's a fight against dullness. The city is full of books, of record shops, of counterculture, of energy, of cosmopolitanism, of style, right? I feel in so many ways this novel is kind of a love letter to London, right? It's, you know, the sheer joy of being young and of being in London, right? And of partaking in that energy, in that countering of the establishment and of institutions. The suburbs, in contrast, the phrase used is a leaving place, right? A place you leave to come into your own, to become your own person. Now, I think what is important to note is that in spite of this kind of very heady description of London and Karim's relationship to it, the city does leave Karim directionless when he arrives there, as it is vertiginous with possibility. That's another phrase from the novel. And so that the city also becomes a place of self-knowledge. Right? So even as it opens up the world to Karim, it's also a place of self-knowledge. Now, of course, as the novel moves on, we see that London is an extremely contested space in the novel, as property speculation, you know, goes out of control. And as we see, as the novel ends, the move towards the neoliberal urban space of the Margaret Thatcher era. So in a way, that sort of book, you know, that is kind of the moment that the novel gestures towards, right? The opening out into the era of Thatcherism, even as the bulk of the novel is set before that. Okay, so the idea then of Englishness as not only rooted in space, right, or as a contestation about space, what space signifies, but also, I think, moving along as a kind of mask. So not just maps of Englishness, I want to suggest, but also masks of Englishness, an idea that I mentioned before, the idea of performing identity. And here I want to mention the ways in which the metaphor of theater in the novel is so central. And of course, the fact that Karim aspires to be an actor and succeeds in doing so to an extent, right? So theater, performance are all very, very key to this novel. And of course, there's a great deal of debate over this question of performing identity, of performing immigrant identity. And I just want to talk about this one episode in which Karim is impersonating Anwar, right? And he falls into the stereotype, and he uses all the stereotypes that are available to him to represent this Asian character. So I want you to think about that particular scene. And then, of course, also the predicament of Jean, the young West Indian actor, who's always made to play roles which are about black people, right, and which are about, which stereotype black people. And I think that through this whole idea, the novel, you know, attempts to show the limits still, right, of Englishness, the kind of identities which it is able to include and assimilate and appropriate, but the kinds that, but then there are other kinds, right, which cannot be made part of the national identity. Okay, what the novel then shows through the roles that these characters perform, and it's interesting that they themselves fall into the stereotype, right? It's not, partly they are being forced to play particular roles, but they also play them willingly. The novel shows the kind of very dangerously small space between a liberal orientalism and racism, right? So the idea, you know, behind racism, of course, is that people who are racially different are the absolute other, right? To be despised and to be kept away. The idea behind liberal orientalism involves a certain kind of desire for the other, right? To appropriate the other, to desire the other. And the novel shows that there's a very thin line separating the two, and one has to be very, very careful and meticulous, right, when thinking about race difference. As we see in the novel, the father turns himself into an exotic, right? Karim is cast as Mowgli. So the ways in which difference can become a certain kind of a fetish, right? Something that is objectified, that becomes a desirable commodity, okay? And that's one of the dangers at the heart of Englishness and its others, the way in which it can accommodate them and appropriate them, okay? I think I'll sort of move to the last bit. There's a whole sort of section on gender, which I won't have time to go into, but maybe I can just kind of mention the whole issue of Jamila's forced marriage in the novel, and I hope you'll get a chance in your seminars to talk about it, precisely because it is a very, very important issue, both within multiculturalism, but also for Black British feminism, right? The way in which the whole idea of forced marriage has sort of gone between the British state, right, trying to rescue Asian women from their communities, right, by which, you know, the slippage is constantly made between arranged marriage and forced marriage, right? And a feminist, a black British feminist move, right, to take the question of women and community into their own hands, right? So Jamila is, I think, a very complex figure from that perspective. If we read the novel, as I do, as referencing and intervening in debates about gender, multiculturalism, racism, etc. So I hope you will have time in your seminars to talk more about it. But let me just end by talking about the structure of the novel and the resolutions it offers as a way to thinking about the novel as a whole. The novel ends with Karim turning 20, so he's no longer a teenager. And in a way, he looks to the future as something that is opening up before him, that is open-ended. And yet, what is interesting for me to note is that even though he's the protagonist, and much of the plot of the novel moves along with his adventures, right, as he comes into the city, it's also interesting that he's an observer of other people's charisma, intelligence, and wit. So he's also a kind of sponge, right? He takes and learns from other people. And so he's quite a complex mix of various cultural influences and forces of his time. So the novel then is about Karim's growing up, questions of puberty, of coming into adulthood. And that coming into adulthood is also, I want to argue, is about coming to terms with his mixedness, right? With his hybridity, with his mongrelism, right? As he says, the odd mixture that he is. And that's one of the main arguments I want to make in this last part, that the novel, in a way, is about coming to terms, okay? And in that way, I'll say a bit more at the very end, but in that way, it's also perhaps not a radical novel, because I read it as a coming to terms, okay? Going to the next one. Another quote to note. Okay, this is the last quote for today that I want to reference. But I did feel, looking at the strange creatures now, the Indians, that in some way these were my people, and that I'd spent my life denying or avoiding that fact. I felt ashamed and incomplete at the same time, as if half of me were missing, and as if I'd been colluding with my enemies to those whites who wanted Indians to be like them. Partly, I blamed Dad for this. Okay, I think that this passage exemplifies what I was saying, this whole idea of coming to terms with who he is, which also becomes a resolution, provides a resolution to the narrative, even as identity is always already a performance. In the previous clip, the quote I had was, to be someone else successfully, you must be yourself, right? So this idea of coming to terms with one's ancestry, with one's mixed heritage, and all the problems associated with it. So that the novel then can be read as a comedy, in the technical sense of the word, as it ends in this kind of returning home, right? He returns home to Indians, which is quite interesting and problematic because he's not really Indian, right? But the novel is also asking, is he really British? He returns to the father, he returns to the family, albeit in a different arrangement. The novel ends with a marriage, with childbirth, and with the fact that for Karim, this change hasn't come about because of any revolution. For me, one of the disappointing things about the novel, because I was so fired up by Jamila and Karim and all these young people thinking that, you know, they can change the world, that Karim does not show up to the demonstration against the National Front. If you know, that's quite a critical moment for me in the novel. Jamila invites him to come for this demonstration. The National Front, as you know, are a far-right, white supremacist group. And Jamila invites him to come for this demonstration and to be in solidarity with other Indians, you know, with other immigrants. And Karim does not show up. This is on page 225. He says, the attack on Changez angered me, and I asked Jamila if I could do anything. Yes, these attacks were happening all the time. I should come with Jamila and her friends on a march the following Saturday. The National Front were parading through a nearby Asian district. There would be a fascist rally in the town hall. Asian shops would be attacked and lives threatened. Local people were scared. We couldn't stop it. We could only march and make our voices heard. I said I'd be there. But actually, he does not go for that march. You also have, at the same time, a city that is being ripped apart. Right, London by the end is being ripped apart as new buildings are coming up. There's strikes, marches, demonstrations. The Labour government loses, and the novel ends with the beginning of Margaret Thatcher's rule. As one of the characters, Terry says, it's either us or the rise of the right. And the novel, I think, documents this quite powerfully, the ways in which the youth rebellion is depoliticized. And you see the rise of yuppie culture under Margaret Thatcher's regime, right? So if the 70s, you know, questioned the hopes and idealism of the 1960s, the 1980s, are going to be a further period of, you know, a complete depoliticization of all the hopes and energies. Qureshi's novel, then, can be seen as a novel that presents the possibilities that are inherent in youth culture, those that animated the decade of the 1960s and the 1970s, and the reality of the subsumption of those possibilities in commodity culture and neoliberal capitalism. That is always a danger posed throughout the novel, right? That the economic right, the political right, has the will and the desire to accommodate, to commodify, right, all the revolutionary potential. The novel, as you must have noted, is published in 1990, which is the end of the Thatcher era. So in a way, even though it's set in the 1970s, it's written in the 80s, published in 1990, and you can sort of see Qureshi writing from the perspective of having lived through the Thatcher era, in which even a discussion of multiculturalism, you know, had become you know, particularly problematic. So in that sense, I think one can read this novel as both a progressive novel, right? The way in which it retrospectively looks back at a time which had potential and which had hope, in spite of the narrative resolution that it offers, right? So in a sense, I think the novel itself is a mixed novel. It shows a coming to terms. It shows the ways in which multiculturalism, I think, then in the 1990s, becomes part of mainstream discourse, right? By the 1990s, nobody really comes out and says, you know, I'm against multiculturalism. As we know, the war on terror and, you know, the other sort of events of the 2000s, I think, have once again shifted the terrain. And you can have somebody like David Cameron, who in a headline speech says that he questions multiculturalism and its continuing efficacy in Britain today. So I think that this novel is really, really interesting, both in terms of the portrait it presents of its particular time, and I think especially for young people, there is, I think, been an interesting renewal of young people's political activism, university students, questioning what they are doing and what is happening, as well as, I think, a quite interesting political comment, right, on the nation and on the presence of immigrants in this nation. So I'm sure there's lots that I've left unsaid, because there's lots to say about this novel, and I hope you will take it forth in your seminars. Thank you.